Coming to you from the great American Southwest, from our studios in suburban Fort Worth, Texas, this is the Dirt Wasp Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Hulsey. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Today's guest is Captain Jay Seffern. Now, we've had Jay on before, and we've called him Colonel Jay Seffern. So why the difference? Well, because today we're going to talk about airlines, airline history, and careers in aviation with airline captain Jay Seffern. Jay, welcome aboard again. Thanks.
Hey, glad to be here. I'm glad always to help you out and to be part of your podcast. I really feel honored.
Well, Jay, you are the heart and soul of the Dirt Wasp Podcast. As you know, I've recorded more episodes with you than with any other single guest.
I did not know that. I always pictured myself as the liver or the pancreas, but I appreciate the compliment.
Well, you can be whichever internal organ you think fits you best. Don't allow me to define you.
Okay, I'll try to remember that.
And so you are an airline captain.
That's correct. I've been with 10 airlines. Did this quite a number of years. It's a very interesting career. It's evolved drastically just in the time I've done it, and I've been in aviation, of course, a lot longer than that before I came to the airline. So I saw some of the, I don't want to say the early days, but the mid days, the golden age of aviation, and then the lead age or whatever, or aluminum age, whatever we're in now, where it's flights for the masses. But I can talk a little bit about its inception, its history, and what we're dealing with today.
Yeah, because we can go back to 1903 when the Wright brothers were the first humans to fly a heavier-than-air vehicle under control, controlled flight of a heavier-than-air vehicle, and then aviation took off from there. Yes, the pun, Jay, the pun was intended. And so,
very good.
Now, as far as commercial flight travel goes, there was the first passenger service was really in dirigibles, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. In 1908, I believe, Delag, I've got to silence my phone here. I have to silence my phone. Sorry about that. Yeah, that's what I understand. 1908, Delag, Deutschland, something, had dirigible service. And, of course, we all know about what happened in 1937, 8 with the Hindenburg, which pretty much ended dirigible service. But, yeah, they were a big item, and they started in Germany. First passenger service, according to what I found on the Internet, in America was this Tampa St. Peterson airboat line in 1914. I guess it flew for 4 months, had a couple of airboats, flew four times a day. But then, of course, the major airlines, some of which are still around, KLM started in 1919, which got bought by Air France, though, about 10 years ago. So I'm not, even though it still flies under the KLM banner and the KLM livery, I'm not sure that still counts as the oldest flying airline because they got bought by Air France. But and some of the other ones also in the time frame. But the legacy ones that we're all familiar with, like Pan Am, Transworld Airlines, Eastern Airlines, those were all founded pretty much in the late 20s, but now they're, of course, all gone. They've combined or been bought out or collapsed, which is kind of sad. But that's one thing I want to impress your readers of early on. And this is also, pun intended, the airline industry has its ups and downs. And I've been in aviation for 44 years, and I've seen the ups and the downs. And we're in a downtime now, obviously, because of the Kung Flu, because of COVID. But we will recover, but then we shall see what brings the airline industry down again in 7 to 10 years. It seems like there's a cycle. So.
Yeah, you mentioned that the first U.S. scheduled air service was in 1914 in Florida, and then there was a gap of 5 years till 1919 when an airline, a European airline, KLM in this case, was founded. And there was a major global event between those years, wasn't there?
There was, yes. And I guess you can credit the Black Hand and a couple other groups called World War One. Yes. And it was a very bloody time period, and as I also try to, every time I talk publicly, you know, I'll consider this a public talking, I try to remind people what the name for World War One was before there was a World War Two, the nickname, which was?
Well, it was called the War to End All Wars.
Yeah,
and subsequent
well
to
that
the, yeah, that's right. Utopian type vision to be sure, but incompatible with all of human history. But that's an entire other podcast. But the development of aviation in that because of World War One for aviation application in that war. I mean, it really aviation really exploded technologically, didn't it?
Oh yes. And we had all famous aviators like Rickenbacker, you know, Captain Eddy, and the Red Baron, and that's where aviation really took off, so to speak. It really it was used for everything from surveillance to strafing to crew, you know, to air interdiction to surveillance and reconnaissance, and it was really where it finally I got its wings, so to speak. We can keep these puns going forever. But, yeah, the, you know, the scores of pilots worldwide turned into thousands of pilots worldwide. So, and then they came back from World War One and became the Barnstormers. And that's where you could go and pay your 5 cents or your nickel or a quarter and get a ride in one. Or they'd go around the nation and do air shows. And that's the origin of the Wing Walkers. And so that really popularized aviation, and that's what got people thinking, oh, yeah, this is a great way to travel. And then in 1926, they passed the Air Service Act, which had the feds establish airmail service, the Kelly Act. And then, I'm sorry, that was 1925. And then in 1926, the Air Service Act, which the feds established airways and promoted air commerce and established certified aircraft, licensed pilots, issued and enforced regulations, all the stuff that we've come now to rely on and take for granted in aviation.
Yeah, and it was
federally chartered airports.
It really was those Barnstormers. Sorry for jumping over you here,
no,
but
you're right.
It really was those Barnstormers. You know, pilots returning from World War One, who you know made their living flying around the United States, usually at county fairs and state fairs and carnivals and things like that, giving rides and doing aerobatic shows and things like that. That really led to the idea that that airplanes could carry mail, which led to the Kelly Act, which was really the first major commercialization of aviation in the United States, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I think also there was contributing to it a strike that now then the Army Air Corps had to take over flying some of these and also had to take over the air traffic. But, of course, the air traffic control system was negligible. You might have one radio beacon. You had flaming barrels, which is how they would land at night in on grass strips. And then you had these giant arrows that were all over the western United States that these airmail guys would follow come good weather or bad. And some of them are still around. You can still see some remnants of these giant concrete arrows. It's really funny, the early navigation systems. It's almost mind-boggling. You think, how did these guys ever survive? But, of course, they were flying aircraft that were made principally of wood and canvas. And in Doolittle's book, I Could Never Be So Lucky Again, he talked about some of his early crashes. And the plane's going pretty slow, and the plane will kind of come apart. So at the end, you sort of try to turn sideways, hit some trees, the plane will come apart, and you can, you know, it would cushion the impact. You're only doing 30 or 40 miles an hour, maybe, and then you can walk away from it in a lot of cases. So it was such a different, almost a comical, almost a fantasy realm compared to what we have now.
Yeah, and you know, just so World War One happens, aviation technology increases dramatically. All of these pilots come back from World War One. Many of them start to barnstorm. There was a strike. I think it was a rail strike. I can't remember right now.
I think you're right. Yeah.
The Army took over air delivery. Then the Kelly Act was passed so that private sector companies and individual pilots who own an airplane could bid on this mail contract, which that air commerce led to the 1926 Air Service Act, which essentially established a regulated aviation industry, including a regulated and an established and regulated airways system. And just as you mentioned, the navigation system, including these big concrete arrows, which, as you said, you can still find them. If somebody is interested, just Google them and images will come up where people hiking and things like that will come across them. And they're not hidden by any means. The ones that still exist are probably, there's probably some hobbyist who has them all plotted on maps and charts. But then in 1927, a visionary by the name of Juan Trippe founded Pan Am.
Right. And Western Air Express was founded in 22 years before that for air transport and also 2 years before that. But you're right. Juan Trippe really introduced Pan Am, made it what it became, the world's premier airline, and it literally did go all over the world, which would eventually lead to its financial issues because no other airline, no other service had to do this. You had to establish radio beacons. You had to establish navigation systems all over the world. You had to maintain, install and maintain those. And so the airline had to fund all that itself. And then as it continued growing, it spread out even more and more, and it had to actually build airports and runways that could sustain the, you know, the jet traffic later on. So it just got deeper and deeper into debt. But it is the reason we have the 747. They went to Juan Trippe's organization, went to Boeing and said, we want an airplane this size. And Boeing says, I don't think we can make an airplane that big. But they did. And that led to the 74, which I flew for five different airlines. It's one of my all-time favorite aircraft.
I think it's one of the most beautiful aircraft ever designed. I remember, you know, it was several times, but sitting in air terminals as one taxis up upon arrival, and it's, the lines are just beautiful. And, you know, it is a remarkable airplane, flown in them. Didn't have, of course, the opportunity to fly them, but have flown in them. Great airplane. But and while we're not going to talk about a history of Pan Am and Juan Trippe, Pan American Airways, under that visionary CEO, Juan Trippe, really established the model for international air travel, didn't it?
It did. It did. It was a progenitor of everything that we take for granted now.
It really. I mean, people just simply, you know, somebody had to pioneer it. And when Juan Trippe said he wanted to fly from continental United States to the Asian continent, people said he was crazy, and he did it anyway. And many of the Pacific Islands, which were to become famous in World War II, Wake Island, I believe, was one of them. Tinian, for sure.
Midway
were all Pan Am waypoints. Were the flying
right,
boats?
Flying boat. Yep. Right. The Yankee Clipper and the Pacific Clipper and all that stuff. Yeah, and it's amazing when you think about it now that. Obviously, ocean across the ocean was in these giant ships, right? And I think it was 1950 when the passenger traffic across the Atlantic Ocean by air exceeded the passenger traffic across the ocean by ship. So think about that. So it took almost 25 years. But within less than 20, within 22 years of the Yankee Clipper being 1927, or 23 years, the passenger traffic exceeded ship traffic. Of course, you get there a lot faster. You know, you spend a day rather than 4, 5, 6 days. So it's amazing the technological advances. And I've said this before also, this discussion for a different time, but look at it. Within 66 years of the Wright brothers flying, we put a man on the moon. So it's incredible how quickly some of these things can happen.
Yeah, you know, between two world wars, a Cold War, and of course, the commercial interests of aviation, aviation technology exploded in the 20th century in ways not seen in any type of technological advance prior in human history, at least in my opinion. And I think, you know, when we talk about people crossing the ocean in ships, a modern audience listening to that doesn't even fathom that. I mean, the closest we get to it really in our everyday type of lives is taking a cruise. And that's about it. But actually going to Europe or Asia on an ocean liner, I don't even know if there are really any ocean liners in service anymore. But that was the preferred means of travel intercontinentally until, like you said, 1950, which in human history terms is, 70 years ago, not that long ago. And aviation really, really has become something that we take absolutely for granted today. And then we had World War II.
Another hot statistic.
Okay,
go ahead. Another hot statistic for you. By the mid-60s, there were about 100 million passengers worldwide that had traveled by jet. This is when the Brits had introduced the Comet, and Boeing had the, the 707, and Douglas had the DC-8s. And but that was by the mid-60s. By 2016, almost 4 billion passengers worldwide, which is most, I think the population of the world is something like 5.6 billion. So now these are not everybody in the world traveling. It can be one person traveling 10 times. But if you think about that, from 1960 to 2016, it went from 100 million passengers to 4 billion passengers. That's incredible. I don't know any other industry that has gone up that fast, except possibly the information age industry, computers, and that has had an immense 4,000-fold increase in that short a period of time. That's just incredible.
Yeah, it is. And I guess, you mentioned computers and computing technology. Perhaps if we look at that industry, we can say that its technological advances occurred at a much more rapid rate than did aviation. But they also are sort of hand in glove because of avionics, and spaceship avionics, satellites and whatnot. The development of those led directly to the development of the computing power that we have today.
So, and that's the other thing I was going to discuss. In just my short 40 years, we've gone from NDBs, non-directional beacon approaches, PARs, precision approach radar, ASRs, airport surveillance radar approaches, which are basically they talk you down. We've gone, and no one does any of those anymore. It was a lot of fun to do in the old days, but the NDB in particular is extremely unreliable and dangerous. But we've gone to those from that to VOR DMEs. And almost every airport now has ILS's, instrument landing system, that has a localizer and a glide slope. Now RNAV GPS approaches, and now they're introducing WAAS, WAAS, and GBAS systems. It's incredible. Every aircraft now has a moving map display, FMS, flight management systems, because they were trying to eliminate the CFIT, the controlled flight into terrain. We all have GPS and enhanced GPS systems in the aircraft, which are ground proximity warning systems. We have all TCAS systems, which warn of other aircraft, trying to eliminate midairs. They went from mode C transponders to mode S transponders. Now we have ADS-B. Which are basically data link between the aircraft and air traffic control, so they know not only where we are, but where we're going, what altitude, what our velocity vector for climbing, descending, accelerating, decelerating. So the technological advancements have just been astonishing. A person that comes into the aviation now has a totally different skill set pretty much than even 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And you see that some of these young guys, they've been flying nothing but FMSs, moving map displays. Well, if they're told when that fails, which Jay's rule in automation is, will always fail you, when that fails, you're back to green needle, you're back to flying VOR radials. And we just had a check ride in my company where a lot of people didn't pass that section because they don't really have a corporate memory of doing that. But that's, that's something that everyone still has to remember. It's a it's still a method of navigation. So anyway, it is astonishing how fast these things are. Now, that's the plus side. It's made it a lot easier, a lot better. Of course, the skies are becoming more and more filled with airplane. The downside, just like I said, automation will always fail you. Remember the garbage in, garbage out, right? Two summers ago, or I think maybe three summers ago, all of a sudden, our navigation systems, our GPSs and our TCASs failed fleet-wide from one day to the next. And the company that installed this stuff said, oh, it was a geostorm. And I go, okay, first of all, there was no geostorm. What kind of load of maloney is this? Turns out they pushed a software update that had missed the time code. And so all of a sudden, our GPSs and our FMSs failed us, and our TCAS failed, which means that's the warning of other aircraft, our proximity warning of other aircraft.
The traffic collision avoidance system, sir.
Exactly. You've very well done. So when one thing knocked out these other two, we're back to no TCAS, we're back to green needle flying, VOR radio flying, which we all, you know, us old timers, no problem. But that company, really, I hope they lost massive, massive lawsuits. Luckily, there was not a crash. There was not an incident. But for them to say, oh, there was a geostorm. Oh, that was just infuriating because I'm an amateur astronomer. There was no stinking geostorm. I knew immediately that was bogus. So anyway.
Well, so you know, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
That's one problem with these technology. We're so interdependent. One thing fails or one thing gets a bad piece of software in it that can knock out all sorts of stuff.
Well, but, you know, I remember reading the NTSB report about that incident. And it actually was a geostorm because the IT guy who pushed out the update was named George Storm.
You lying sack.
Bada boom. Okay.
You could have come up with a much better one than that. That was anyway.
Well, I take them as they come, you know.
Yeah, I know.
The opportunity arose.
Yes.
Well, you know, with all that high tech stuff, you talked about, you know, the younger generation pilots don't know how to do the green needle flying. I remember it's probably back in 2005, maybe. It could have been that long ago, but I flew a 182 from Andrews Air Force Base to Charleston, South Carolina, and it had GPS navigation. And all you had to do was keep that little airplane icon on top of the magenta line. And as long as you were flying at your assigned altitude, squawking your assigned code, and you were just followed that line. And I remember talking to the guy I was flying with. He was a C-5 pilot by trade. I said, this takes the thinking out of flying.
It really does.
Good, is it?
No, and I was flying a 7-4 for one of my less moneyed, less maintained companies, shall we say. All three, I think one INS was already deferred, had already crapped out. One INS became unreliable, and one failed in flight. So now we are back to, and I'm over the Mediterranean in this 747. So I took I just started DRing, which dead reckoning, which is time and direction. Tried to estimate the winds we were at, and this is a mental process that we all learned in the old days, where you backed up everything else with just a mental estimate, right? And I took my cell phone out and put it in the back window, which didn't have the electric mesh to keep it warm, so I could get a GPS signal, and so as we're navigating through the Mediterranean, the middle of the Mediterranean, we were there for a couple hours, basically with no internal navigation except what I was doing with my my DR and my GPS. When we finally got back into radio range, we were, I think, 12 miles off course, which was not too bad considering, and of course I'm estimating the winds, and at 36,000 feet, that's pretty hard to do. So. But that was not too shabby. And the other crew members were saying, wow, that's amazing. We never seen anyone do that. And I said, well, that's what they taught us in the old days. But, and you know, every time you think something can't happen, it will. So it was, and of course my cell phone was starting to get GPS signals. So I could actually try to, but you know, when you get a whole bunch of lat long numbers, you don't really have time to plot them, particularly when you're faithful co-pilot really has no clue what's going on. So, but anyway, yeah, things have changed drastically. But anyway, and like I say, a lot of times people don't think anymore. I saw that when I was instructing in some aircraft for a major company. I would turn off some of their automation. For instance, one of the things I really like about the aircraft that I fly now is it does not have VNAV, vertical navigation, and does not have auto throttles. So you have to, be a pilot. So I really like that. So all the guys that have the high automation, they just watch the automation do everything. And it's kind of scary, actually. I used to turn it off, and about half of the time, they'd get lost. And you notice what happened with that Korean Air 777 in San Francisco. The auto throttles were not functioning, but the captain was still relying on something that wasn't there. And nobody else, three other pilots in the cockpit, nobody else spoke up. And they were, I think, 43 knots below VREF, which is your minimum speed, your minimum maneuver speed. And they slammed into the runway, or actually, the overrun in San Francisco. I think everyone survived the crash, but two gals died in the aftermath of the crash. But it was completely, completely unnecessary. And if your listeners want to read a very, very good book that has a chapter on aviation, Outliers is an extremely good book. And it talks about how the crews that don't talk in some of these countries where prestige is everything, some of the South American countries and like Korea, that inevitably leads to a crash because people are thinking it, but they're not saying it. Hey, we're out of fuel, or hey, we got some issues, but they don't transmit it to the captain. So,
yeah, I haven't read that book, but that particular crash, it was traced back to the way Korean Airlines trained its pilots, and that the captain was God.
Right.
And if you, were the co-pilot or the flight engineer, if it had one, or a third pilot on a long flight, that you didn't question the captain. And it was, part cultural and part an artifact of, at least early on, most of their pilots came from the South Korean military. And so it had a very heavy military overlay where the captain was king.
And in the book Outliers, it's actually, I think, dated from 06. So it talks about that very system in Korea and how the American Airlines, after the Koreans had a whole bunch of crash, the American Airlines or the FAA said, hey, you're not flying in America anymore. And this is, I think, the late 90s. And so they had to clean up their whole culture, or so we thought. And then what happens, in 2016, I guess it was, this crash happens, which tells me they've kind of reverted back to that old culture. So
when was that crash in the Azores, the 274s?
Tenerife, yeah. 85.
No, it was 86? It was in the 70s, I thought. That's what my mind told me.
Let me Google it real quick.
75 or 76.
Yeah, that was the world's worst aviation disaster. And that was the chief pilot for KLM that said, hey, we're going.
Yeah, and it was another instance of the co-pilot. It was unclear about what tower had told them. And
March 27th, 1977. You are absolutely correct.
Okay. The tower, as I recall reading about the incident, the tower told the KLM flight to hold. I don't remember if it was in position and hold or hold short, whichever it was. But the captain heard, something different. He thought they were cleared to take off. The co-pilot wasn't sure what tower had said, didn't believe that it was, he was dead, so nobody interviewed him outward, but it was thought because of some of the cockpit voice recorder between the two, it was clear the co-pilot was unsure of what tower had said and what the tower instruction was. But that KLM chief pilot had the reputation of biting the heads off his co-pilots.
Wow. I had not heard that, but that doesn't surprise me. I think what happened what I dimly remember when they did one of these reenactments is there was another radio transmission that actually garbled what the tower had said. And so like you say, KLM flight 1654, hold or something. And so they didn't actually fully understand it, but then the KLM pilot says, we're going. it was a real foggy. So the Pan Am aircraft is crossing the runway because they, in the fog, had gotten, I guess, turned around. I heard the co-pilot of the Pan Am flight talk at a talk one time, and he said he knew that that KLM aircraft was moving because the landing lights were jiggling. You know, they were vibrating a little bit, telling him, uh-oh. And he actually ducked down as that aircraft cut the top off of the 7-4. The flight engineer falls through the deck down to the main cabin. And of course, the KLM, everyone's lost on the KLM aircraft, and I think one third of the people on the Pan Am. Nobody makes a radio transmission, so the first indication the tower had was another aircraft taxiing around saying, hey, what's all this flaming debris doing out here on the taxiway? So it was really a disaster. 583 people died, 61 injuries. Holy smokes.
Yeah, and you know, it's pilot 101. If you're unsure what tower or ask. ATC or center has told you, you ask.
You ask.
Yep, absolutely.
Exactly.
Get clarification.
Exactly.
And you know, like a lot of things, people do something for a long time, and the it's a complacency of a type that sets in that I know what I'm doing, and I've been doing this for so long, and I, you know, they just know what they know.
My company actually has us brief on every light, and I really think very highly of my company. We do what's called a want brief, and at the end, the T is the major threat. And there's been times, I would say maybe a quarter of the time, we say weather is the biggest threat, or icing, or we have an issue with something on the aircraft, or I've never been to this airport before. But about a quarter of the time, we discuss, hey, I wonder if the biggest threat is complacency. And myself and the co-pilot will discuss that. So, you know, keep our edge. And if you see something, say something. If you don't like something, I probably don't like it either. You know, I want to hear a lot of talking in my cockpit, and I've told my co-pilots that, and they say thank you, because some of these other captains, particularly, like I say, from like South American countries, I've actually flown on aircraft as co-pilots where the captain says, I don't want to hear one word. And that's kind of dangerous, if you get my drift.
Well, there's a buddy of mine, he's been on the podcast a couple of times, who is a corporate jet pilot. And he's flown with a couple of guys like that, and he won't fly with them again.
I won't either. Yeah, that's scary.
It's so unsafe. It's incredible. You know.
Now I assume, and I have to believe this, that when the captain says that, he means I don't want to hear one word about anything else. But if you see something safety related, speak up. I assume that's what he means, but he hasn't said that. And also that's going to make Joe, little co-pilot who's brand new and who's timid, not say anything of that, you know, that little voice that's in the back of your head says, the fuel flow isn't right. Or, maybe we're at 3.6 and we were assigned 2.6 or, you know, there's that doubt. And you've got to play that hand. So many times I've had that old feeling something's not right. And gee whiz, something isn't right. So, what a surprise, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned you worked for 10 different airlines, and that sounds, that may sound to some to be unusual, but it's not, is it?
I do run into the people that have been their entire career, one or two airlines, because I chose to do, and we'll talk about the ups and downs of the industry, but because I chose to do overseas cargo pretty much. I was with a couple of different major cargo airlines, and then in 08, with the crash of 08, my airline went out of business, and now I took the first job I was offered, which was with another 7-4 carrier to do a Hajj. And if your viewers don't know what a Hajj is, it's one of the five pillars of Islam. And then the next year I did another Hajj with a different company. And then I flew another cargo company, the Hajj contract. There are people that fly just to Hajj once a year, and then they take the rest of the year off. And the Hajj goes from like 1 October, the end of Ramadan, to basically 1 January. So they can make enough money in those 3 months that they can not do anything the rest of the year. And then in between those two things, like I say, my brother died in a plane crash, so I was dealing with his estate and everything. So just the luck of the draw. But then I came back to America, and now I've been basically with one company for 7 years. So
yeah, and I do want to note that when you said the crash of 08, you were talking about the economic crash of 2008, not an aircraft crash.
No.
So the economic crash of 2008. And I have to say that so far in the podcast, Jay, you have described the audience as readers, listeners, and now viewers. So, you know, I hope they're all those things. I fear they're only one of those things.
Well, they can picture what we look like, so they're viewers. And how can I get around the readers thing? If it's closed captioned for the hearing impaired, they can be readers. How am I doing?
Or they could just go to the website. That's one way to read something. So let's talk about the volatility of the airline industry. You know, you talked about the ups and downs, and we'll get to the left banks and right banks, pitch yaw and roll and all that kind of stuff. But talk about from going back to basically the 1960s, which I guess was still part of the golden age of air travel, but it started to change, didn't it?
It did. The 1960s, when I was growing up, my mom put me in a coat and tie and said, you're on your best behavior to get on an airplane. And they had, you know, the stewardesses had white gloves and they put down a white tablecloth and it was a different era. But that's when we had only 100 million passengers worldwide. Then a couple things happened. We had the Vietnam War wore down. So then we had a glut of pilots. So you could not really find a job in the industry. A lot of them were helicopter pilots. A lot of them were rotor heads. Now we have a program. A lot of airlines have a program to take a rotorcraft pilot or even a tilt rotor pilot, a powered lift pilot, is what they call them now, and transition them into fixed wing. But so it was very hard. Plus the economy was not doing well in the 70s, as you recall. We had the OPEC crisis, so no one was hiring. Luckily or unluckily, a lot of people think it was a good idea. I do too. A lot of people see a downside. They deregulated the airlines in the late 70s. So now we had the upstart airlines come, which I think was actually very healthy for the industry. Plus, it drastically lowered tickets. What a surprise. You get competition, and all of a sudden the ticket prices go down. So then the evolution or devolution into a bus for the masses in three dimensions started happening, but the ridership went sky high, as we've already discussed. But no one was hiring in the 70s. In the 80s, we had boom times until the economic downslide, aka crash of 87, and that was due to the savings and loan crisis. Most people have forgotten that one. So the airline industry, my friends that got hired in 84, some of them found themselves on the street or furloughed in 87. But by the mid-90s, that had all recovered. In 92, we stood down from the Cold War. So again, we had a glut of pilots. And again, the economy was not doing that great. But then the 90s were boom time. And everybody was hiring in the 90s. I was flying on fires, and I loved that. That was the most satisfying civilian job I'd ever had. But I also was going to a funeral of some of my comrades every 6 weeks. So I knew that my number was going to be up one of these days. But everyone's hiring in the 90s, and then 9/11 happens in 2001. So that set the industry way back. And in fact, as you may know, as your listeners may know, American Airlines had bought TWA, and then within a week of 9/11, they furloughed just thousands of former TWA pilots and some American pilots. It took 13 years to recover some of those furloughees. And 13 years is a long time. You know, you have to go find another job. You fly for other airlines if you can get hired, or you can go do something else. Anyway, so then 9/11 throws a wrench in the industry. Then it's going gangbusters. It takes about 8 months to recover the economy from 9/11, if I remember correctly. But it takes 2 or 3 years to recover the airline industry. And then the crash, the economic downturn of 08 happens, if you recall. And that's when fuel prices hit, $3.50 a gallon, and we had issues in 08, and that's when my airline that I was flying for, which I really liked, also went under economically, went bankrupt. And then things start going again, and now we get hit with the Kung flu, with the COVID. So now they're saying it'll take 3 to 5 years to recover. International travel has almost completely dried up, which is understandable. Domestic is not doing too bad. My airline is actually has more business than last year, but that's because some of the majors have parked airplanes. If your listeners want to see a parking lot of thousands of aircraft, go out to Roswell, New Mexico. It's incredible how many aircraft are out there. It seems like every 7 to 10 years, something happens in the aviation industry. So if I were to give advice for people who wanted to join this industry, I would say have a second career in your back pocket. Don't rely on when the good times are good, yeah, you make a ton of money, you're flying all the time, life is good. But that furlough can be just around the corner, or your airline can be bought out, or something can happen. So almost everybody I know in the industry that's been in the industry for 40 years has had one or two furloughs under their belt. So I hope that makes sense. That's just a warning, but it's one of experience.
Yeah, I know a guy who was furloughed from TWA, and I think he spent nearly 20 years on the furlough list, and was it was a long time. I may be overstating it, but it was an incredibly long time. And when they called him back, he was already making way more money in what he was doing than he could as an airline pilot, and so he turned him down. Also, the airline as an industry created, and this is probably, I don't know if this is the 1970s or 1980s, but created two pay scales, Schedule A and Schedule B. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard about it. That was never in any of my airlines that I worked for, and I don't know if that, I know the unions were squawking like heck, but they were trying to bring in some people when they were under financial stress, people at a lower pay scale, new hires. I don't know too much about it. I do know people that were in some of those airlines. I don't think that still exists. I could be wrong. So I know there was a lot of opposition to it, and if the airline had to do, but then again, you really, you know, American Airlines was under alleged bankruptcy, if you recall, in 2012 and 2013. And yet they decided to spend $200 million on rebranding, new uniforms, which my friends say look terrible and feel terrible, but okay. And new paint job, which I think was a mistake because American Airlines had the most recognizable paint job in the industry, and now they go to something that looks like any other airline. But okay, they didn't ask me, but they spent all this money in bankruptcy to do something that I thought was completely, I mean, people don't care what the plane, they need the plane to be clean, and they want to be on time, and they want to be safe, but they don't care the paint job or the uniform that the flight attendants or the pilots are wearing. I mean, that is just unnecessary, but some middle-level manager probably got a promotion out of doing that or something. I don't understand it. That $200 million could have gone many better places, like getting the ramp situation to work. For a while there, it was pitiful. We'd land here at DFW and wait 52 minutes for a gate. And I'm going, you know, and I shut down one engine, got one engine running and the APU, and maybe even shut down both engines with the APU running, but I'm burning all that fuel, waiting, passengers are frustrated. One time, the aircraft next to me made a call after they'd been waiting 50 minutes and made a call, hey, we've been out here 50 minutes, we need paramedics. And then 5 minutes later, the same airplane made a call, hey, we're out here and we need paramedics and police. So that's all the information I have, but what conclusion would you come to?
Passengers got angry and there was a fight.
Exactly. That's how I would conclude that. Or they assaulted a flight attendant or something. Or, you know, I don't know anything more than that because we'll never find out. I'll never find out. But and that's the next thing I want to talk about. If your listeners / readers / viewers are interested in passenger behavior, And I actually should do a newspaper column on it because it is deteriorating from the merely bizarre to the annoying, and now even the criminal. The FAA just yesterday said, okay, we're now going to start pressing criminal charges on people who, because it's a federal offense not to obey a flight attendant in pursuance of his or her duties. And if you assault one, they're not going to not do civil penalties, but they're going to do criminal penalties because it's getting ridiculous. And it's not just about masks. It started deteriorating before that. Not only the behavior, but the dress, the demeanor, the I don't know, societal norm. How do you describe a big fellow walking through the secure side of Chicago O'Hare in pink pajamas with pink fuzzy feet?
I would describe that as a big guy in pink pajamas and pink fuzzy feet.
Pink fuzzy feet. I said he wanted to be comfortable, but I guess he thought that was acceptable clothes to wear on an airplane. So, okay. Then there was a guy that had so much metal stuck in his head and his face that I thought he was going to interfere with our navigation system. And my co-pilot said, oh, he's trying to make a statement. Okay, I accept that. What statement, may I ask, is he making, may I ask? So maybe your listeners can help me out with that one. It was a guy that had his hair up in a cone that was about half a meter above his head, and half was red and the other half was black. And I almost tapped him on the shoulder and said, look, if you're going to follow the nautical and aeronautical convention, the left half should be red and the right half should be green. I didn't say that, though. You know, that's so we know which direction they're going at night, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I really think you should have, because that kind of on-the-spot correction can help everyone's navigation. Absolutely.
Yes.
Briefly, let's talk about that, because you mentioned it, that there was once a time in which people dressed up to take an airline flight.
Oh, yeah. And now it's dressing. I mean, okay, I just was flying to Aspen where, okay, you have the supermodels that always seem to have a big furry hat and big furry boots, but okay. And then right next to them, you'll have a guy, a scruffy looking guy with a beard, who has a backpack and is in shorts and sandals. And I'm going, well, I don't say anything because I'm Mr. Nice Guy. I'm Mr. Non-Judgmental. I'm Mr. Sergeant Schultz. But you're getting off the airplane. It's 10 degrees out there and you're in sandals and short pants. But okay, it's up to you. You know, you want to freeze your noogies off. Okay, fine, whatever. But it's just, it's amazing to me. And I've told my wife and all my family, if you get on an airplane, I'd like you in long pants and long shirts of something, preferably non-polyester, closed-toed shoes. Why would I want that? And I always make them tell me a number when we sit down in our seats. That number is how many rows of seats between you and the nearest exit, because I want you to be able to find that exit if vision is obscured for whatever reason. And I want you to be able to, closed-toed shoes and long pants and long shirt of something that's not synthetic. Gee, why would I want that?
Well, in case the airplane goes down and there's a fire, the clothing won't melt into the person, and the person will be better dressed to exit the aircraft under adverse conditions. And we should maybe talk about that. But rather than talking about what people dress like, because anybody in the United States who goes to Walmart will see some of these people, and I'm sure, because we have an international audience here at the Dirt Wasp podcast. So I know in the United Kingdom, Walmart has stores, but it's under a different brand name. And so, but, you know, these big box shopping stores, that's a good place to go. You just Google Walmartians and just hit images, and you'll see a lot of interesting things. But rather than talk about what people look like or how they're dressing and things like that, let's talk about the behavior very briefly about the behavior deterioration of passengers on regularly scheduled airlines.
Well, even before the Kung Flu hit, the COVID hit, It was deteriorating, and there were passengers who would sit in the wrong seat, and then someone would come up with their boarding card and say, "Hey, you're in my seat," and they'd say, "Go find another one." Okay. We had cases of passengers coming on the airplane with something that couldn't possibly fit in the upper luggage compartments, you know, or overhead luggage compartments, and they would insist on having the seat next to them, but of course they didn't pay for that seat. We had these comfort animals, and I had a Great Dane on my aircraft one time, which arguably should not have been on the airplane, but also should have had to buy a seat, because a Great Dane was a huge, it stuck its head in the cockpit, and I'm programming the FMS, and I thought it was a horse, you know, because the head was actually above my head. And I look over, there's a huge nose, big floppy ears, and I thought, at first I thought it was a girl I used to date, but then I thought, is there a saddle for this horse here? But anyway, so now, praise the Lord, they've actually changed the rules. And now Alaskan and American have said no more of these comfort animals. We were all briefed at the time, 5-6 years ago, their service animals are allowed. And those are important. They're certified. They're very well behaved. No one never had an issue with the service animal, but these comfort animals pooping everywhere, attacking other passengers. You know, this has been ridiculous. One guy tried to bring on a peacock. Another tried to bring an alligator. I was waiting for someone to try to bring on a rattlesnake, you know, something venomous as well as not possibly having to do with comfort. But anyway, so yeah, the passengers were starting to get ornery and disobedient, dressing down, you know, cut off some flip-flops, not behaving themselves, arguing, showing up drunk and or stupid, which is amazing. And every time I keep thinking I've seen it all, I fly another flight, and then I see something that I just can't believe. For instance, recently, I was waiting at a gate for my aircraft to come in, and there was across the way, they were announcing the departure of a flight, and they paged a person by name, and paged that person three times, and finally closed the door. And once you close the door, that's it. You're not going to open it again unless it's like an emergency. And then that person that they were paging turned out to be the person sitting right next to the gate agent that was paging her, and she didn't respond. She's not wearing a name tag, so the gate agent doesn't know who this person is. And then she runs up to this gate agent, because I witnessed this, saying, "Oh, I need to get on that airplane." And the gate agent said, "I just paged you three times, and you're sitting 3 feet away from me, and you didn't respond, and now the door's closed," and she starts making a big scene. Another gal, when her flight was canceled by weather, you know, starts screaming profanities. That's my personal favorite, when there's like 300 people in the gate area and someone starts screaming the F word or something, you know, she starts screaming profanity. Finally, and I walk over and stand next to the gate agent, just in case, you know, and I'm a little tall and perhaps pseudo intimidating, I don't know. The gate agent rebooks her for a flight. She sort of semi-calms down after about 10 minutes of screaming and goes away. Then I go away and come back about 10 minutes later, and I see the cops have arrested her. And I go, that's really odd, because usually if someone calms down, there's no harm, no foul. It really should be a foul, in my opinion. But anyway, turns out she had turned around, gone over to the gift shop that's 30 feet away, and started buying stuff with counterfeit $20 bills. And I'm going, you know, she didn't ask me for advice, but if I'm a criminal genius, I'm not going to draw attention to myself before I go try to buy stuff with counterfeit money. But again, she didn't ask me. So every time I think I've seen it all, it's astonishing. You know, but I do want to give a shout out to the airport ambassadors. They handle a lot of things. They prevent a lot of the trouble from getting to the gate agents. And I also want to give a shout out to the gate agents. They intercept a lot of the people who are drunk or high and they're supposed to keep them off the airplane, and they really have their work cut out for them. But still, things have happened. One flight recently, a guy comes down the jetway, meaning he got past the gate agent, and he has to beep in, supposedly, with his ticket. He comes down the jetway. He's in the airplane. He's got a yellow boarding card, and we're going, and he goes, "Oh, is this a flight to Cancun?" And I go, "No, and you have a boarding card from Spirit. How did you get down here? Oh, I must be on the wrong airplane. Yes. How did you get down here? So you can, you know, sometimes people can slip through the cracks, and I still don't know how he got down here, but we escorted.
And I think we lost Jay. I think we did. I think we lost him. Hello, Jay. Hello, Jay. Well, folks, we lost Jay. Oh, he's dialing back in. Hello, Jay.
And I'm on my house phone.
Yeah, I know. It was still a solid call on my end. So I would call your telephone company and do as that woman did at the gate agent. Just don't follow it up by shopping with counterfeit bills.
Scream profanity for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That's really going to be helpful.
Yeah. Well, no, I used to do a lot of business travel, and I've seen my share of people melting down at the airport. And I always, you know, it's something I never did, wouldn't do. And sometimes, I mean, people can be tired and frustrated and have a bad day and things like that. And it's just this, you know, the flight delayed or canceled is just one more scoop of unhappiness that is, put in their bowl for the day. And
well, then go home and kick your dog. Don't scream at my poor gate agent.
Well, I would advise everyone against mistreating any animals. I would suggest you know, go work out or something, or do some push-ups or meditate.
Okay.
But we're not going to advocate for mistreating any animals.
No, you better. Yeah, you better take that out of it, because now I'll get the PETA will be all over me like a bad smell.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, but you know, we're bumping up to an hour now, and
okay.
I do want to get to, for people who are interested in careers in aviation, you know, what can you tell them? I mean, obviously, the cheapest way to receive professional pilot level training is through the armed forces.
But what happened, though, and I'm not saying you're wrong, and I want to encourage people that feel like that's what they want to do. But what happened in when I first came in as a cadet, I think it was a 4-year or a 6-year commitment after pilot training, after flight training. But now I think it's 10 years. So I just want people to have their eyes open that it'll be at least 11 years you're going to be on active duty after flight training or including flight training. So that is certainly one way, and the military is always looking for good people. The other way is what I've had a lot of friends do. They go to one of these universities, or Embry-Riddle, like University of North Dakota has a pilot training program. Purdue has one now. I think you should have a second career. Like, you should be, like, I was trained as an aeronautical engineer, and occasionally I've had to fall back on that kind of thing, and sometimes I still do it. I'm on an advisory panel with NASA for wake turbulence and things like that. But so I would suggest definitely get a 4-year degree. You can always go and fly and get your ratings, and there's a lot of schools that will do that. Plus, you can do it in your spare time. I know a lot of middle-aged folks. I know a guy who became a dentist and said, I don't like doing this. I guess it was like pulling teeth. And he decided to come and be an airline pilot. And lots of people in the midlife have decided to do that. What you do is you go get trained, you go get your private instrument commercial ticket, go find someone that will hire you or instruct until you get like 1,200 or 1,300 or 1,400 hours, then apply to one of these regionals. A lot of time the regional will pay to get your ATP CPL, which you have to now have. And that's a result of one of the crashes we had back in 08, the crash up in Buffalo. And so then once you're on with a regional, you keep your nose clean. You do that for 2 or 3 or 4 years, sometimes even less, sometimes more. And then sometimes the majors will hire you. So, but that's under normal times now. There's a glut of pilots because everyone's parked airplanes. So they say it's going to take 3 to 5 years to recover. We'll see. If this if this virus is controlled by the vaccine, and if this sucker doesn't mutate, which is what I'm afraid of, then maybe we've dodged this bullet worldwide, unlike 1918 with the Spanish flu.
But well, so you mentioned the ATP-CPL. That's the Airline Transport Pilot Certificate. What does the CPL edition mean?
Oh, boy. Is it commercial pilot license or commercial? I don't remember offhand because I never had to get one. But that was when they had the Colgan crash in Buffalo, they started scratching the surface, and the co-pilot had only, I don't know, like 200 hours or something. And they said, okay, we want everyone that's in air transport to have a ATP, the Air Transport Pilot Certificate, which is 1,500 hours and a pretty intensive check ride and a very long series of tests. And then the airline said, we're going to go one step further, or the Fed said, we're going to go one step further. Anyone that goes to the airlines not only has to have that, but also has to have, I think, 6 hours in a simulator where you're trained and you're given a check ride in flying a jet. And I guess that the airlines will actually pay for it, so you don't have to pay for it. But you're under their scrutiny. And I've known not a lot, but I've known some people that I think it's meant to weed out people that can't think at jet speed, which I think is what led to the first H-60 rule back by C.R. Smith. They had a lot of World War II guys that were flying props. And, yeah, it's great to be thinking at 150, 170 knots, but that's not like, you know, thinking at 400 or 500 knots. So. Plus, they all smoked and drank back then, so it was probably wise in its day, but it's gone to 65, and that's why I'm timing out in 3 months.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, you know, that you're as ancient as you are.
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think didn't you used to go to parties at the Orville Wright's house?
No, but funny you mentioned that. One of my professors at Purdue. Larry Carnino, he sat on a board. He died at age 99 about 10 years ago, but he sat on a board in World War II that was chaired by Orville Wright. And so that was amazing that I was one step away from one of the Wright brothers. So Wilbur Wright died quite young, but Orville lasted for a while. So
you see,
one degree of separation. That was it.
Yes. They say everyone is 6 degrees of separation away from somebody famous or well-known. Yeah. But you see how skillfully I directed the conversation to that little anecdote?
It was.
I mean, you have to admire my ability to have done that in this conversation.
I'm very close to admiring that.
Well, you know, that's good enough for me, Jay. So C.R. Smith, if memory serves, was this the CEO of American Airlines, who later became the administrator of the United States Federal Aviation Administration.
I believe you're correct, and I think he's the one that pushed. Even before he became the FAA or CAA back then, he was pushing for the H-60 rule. Some people say it was an anti-union thing. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, we're at 65, and Congress changed that without the FAA's input. They changed it about 8 years ago, 9 years ago to 65. Some countries have no age limit. Some countries have 68. Some countries have 70. I flew on fires with a retired Air Force colonel who was 80, but I really think his time had come. So if you still have your mental faculties and if you still have your health, I think, you know, 70 would be reasonable. People are living longer. They're, you know, healthier. They're not smoking and drinking like they used to and so on and so forth. But I guess it's also an individual thing.
Well, I can tell you, I don't want to be accused of ageism, but we do slow down, even if we're in excellent health. We do slow down. Our reaction time slows down as we age.
That's true.
You know, I noticed, you know, although I haven't flown in several, gosh, I hate to say it, several years now. It's hard to believe, but the difference between when I first started and you know, the couple of years I last flew was not too unsafe, not to be unsafe at all, but you know, it wasn't that extreme. But I could tell the difference, and just like, you know, because I started flying in my early 20s, so you know, it's a lot different, you know, when you're in your late 40s. And at the time, I think that's probably when I last flew before I turned 50.
But, you know, you say that, but it's not so much reaction time in the airlines. It's a cool head and being able to process things.
Well, that's what I mean. Being able to process things, to be able to process information and then act upon it. I'm not talking about simply, you know, motor skill reaction. I'm talking about having, you know, all the situational awareness and then acting on what not only instrumentation inputs that you're getting, but where appropriate. And it's not always appropriate in aviation, but where appropriate, your sensory inputs as well, and then acting upon those things. And you know, there was a King Air, was it 300, that crashed at Dallas Love Field last spring. Do you remember that?
I do not. What's the deal there?
Well, it was I don't want to go into that whole story, but it ended up taking off, bad engine, and it ended up rolling into the bad engine, and then it nosedived into a hangar and killed everybody on board. And that pilot was 71, I think, or 70 years old, and some of the immediate post accident information indicated that he maybe had been past his prime.
And took off with a bad engine
and you know, just didn't pay attention to what the instruments were telling. But anyway, I mean, everybody is different. I mean, I know a woman who's 78, going to be 79 this year, who is an author and a fitness instructor, who can wear a 2-piece bikini and turn heads even at her age. She's a Pilates instructor, a yoga instructor, and a personal trainer. So I mean, it's possible, and she's sharp as a tack. So it's possible to last a long time. So, but anyway, there is that 65 age rule where people who are in scheduled airline flying have to step out of that profession. And you're coming up very close to that, aren't you?
Right. 3 months. And let me give you an example, though. We have these young guys come in, these young millennials, and I'm seeing a different behavior pattern in millennials. I don't know if you're seeing it too, but they don't really join things very much, and they don't stick with things. If there's difficulty, they bag out. There were quite a few people that left my pilot training company, my latest airline in pilot training, and I was really surprised to see these people go, because they just said, "Oh, it's too hard," or "I'm not gonna, I don't want this," or whatever. So it was not what I expected. Let me put it that way. But also, sometimes these young folks, they will react rather than act. And I've seen that in the simulator, and I've seen that in flying. If you have an emergency in flying, you don't need to just start throwing switches and stuff, or even yanking on the control column. You need to ponder and think the best route given various possible routes. And I'll give you an example. I was flying, I think, out of Detroit to Chicago. This is about a year ago. I had a medical emergency on board. So right there, that's a stressor. We don't know what's happened. This gal has collapsed. So we know we want to get it on the ground, but do we want to even divert to some even closer base? Well, I'm going by what the flight attendants are telling me. And I think there was either a doctor or a nurse on board that was taking care of this gal, but we don't know what the situation is. So there's a stressor there. Then we're entering pretty heavy icing. We already had a issue with the aircraft. A pack was deferred. In other words, one of the air treatment systems was not working. We have two, but that means we're limited to some of the things we can do because of this pack deferral. And then on final, I'm the flying pilot. I have I was getting a check ride. I have a line check airman in the right seat. And on final, we're entering pretty heavy icing. Both our anti-ice systems start failing. Now, I'm at a decision tree. Let's see. I could go around and try to get this thing fixed. I could try to continue the approach and land it in heavy icing. I could transfer the controls to the other pilot and work the quick reference handbook of this, the troubleshooting system. So there was a decision tree, and I pondered it for a minute, looked at him and said, I'm going to continue. And the procedure calls for typically the captain to transfer the controls and the radio to the co-pilot and then work the QRH, the quick reference handbook. In this case, I deviated from standard procedure. I said, I'm going to continue the approach, see if you can cycle the anti-skid system. We have already an issue with the aircraft, and we have a medical emergency on board. So I'm making a decision here that we're just going to continue the approach and get it on the ground. Even if we accumulate some ice, I can keep it above 230, so it won't be on the wings. And that's what we did. And on the ground, he said I did extremely well. And I said, thank you. But, there's lots of different decision points here, but we did what we needed to do. We got on the ground, no issues, taxied in. She gets the medical attention she needs. I just felt like throwing a match into that airplane and getting rid of it, but I didn't. So we just wrote up everything. So that's what you just need to. And when you have multiple emergencies or multiple issues, it becomes a real, sometimes a stress point where you have to make decisions that ordinarily you can't really think through on the ground. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It absolutely does make sense. You know, we were going to do a 45-minute podcast, and we're bumping up to an hour and a quarter. And, I mean, it's a great conversation. And even though you successfully alienated some segments of society who may be listening to this.
Animal lovers.
Exactly, principally. So, once again, we don't advocate abusing animals in any way, shape, or form.
No.
So if you're upset, just, do meditate, do a workout, do push-ups, go run around the block,
go
do something.
Run.
It always helps. But
I do have one last story, if you have time, for your listeners/readers/viewers.
Well, of course. You are the guest.
Well, if you recall, I don't know if I've told this before. If you recall, there was a CT-43, which is the military version of a 737, crashed in Dubrovnik in 1996, that killed Ron Brown, our Secretary of Interior, and everyone else on board. So for years, I pondered and puzzled about that crash. But I read at the time, in 1996, there was Lieutenant Colonel Jim A., to shorten his last name, who I said, I know a guy by this name that was the squadron commander, and actually had left that squadron 5 days prior to the crash. So we do our 40th year reunion at my alma mater, and there's this fellow of the same name. And I said, hey, by the way, were you involved with the CT-43 squadron? He says, yes, I was the squadron commander. And I said, aha. So it's the first time in 40 years I had a conversation with him. And back in the day, he and I did not really get along that well. His call sign, he's a tall Hawaiian, half Hawaiian guy. His call sign was Dr. No. And that fits his personality. It's so funny. But anyway, so he gave me the scoop on this. So and if you recall that crash, they said pilot error. Well, that's the media, number one, not knowing what they're talking about, and number two, not getting the facts right. Gee, what a surprise. So here is the scoop on that crash. He and Jim, being Dr. No, he read all 7,000 pages of the accident report twice. The executive summary was a mere 89 pages long. You know, how much is a normal executive summary? One or two pages, right?
Right.
The executive summary is 89 pages. But here's the three dominoes that fell into place. They're flying into very, very bad weather in Dubrovnik. They are flying a dual NDB approach, non-directional beacon. Now, every airline I've been with has said we do not do NDB approaches, and no airline I've ever known has authorized a dual NDB approach. It's very, very dangerous because these are very unreliable. So there's a power line that runs up the side of the mountain into Dubrovnik from a power station. NDBs are notorious for pointing to whatever's emitting EMF, electromagnetic radiation. So if there's a lightning storm, the ADF needle will swing over towards where there's a lightning strike and then swing back to the radio beacon it's trying to track. So every Croatian pilot knew if there was bad weather, you flew 5 degrees to the right of the ADF needle. Our pilots had no way of knowing that. So now they're in very heavy weather, they're off course. And here's the last domino. when the Russians left Dubrovnik in 1996, they took with them the ILS, the instrument landing system. Jeppesen did not change the height above touchdown from the ILS height above touchdown, which is about 200 feet, to the NDB height above touchdown, which is like 800 or 1,000 feet. Let me take a drink of something here. So they're flying an NDB approach, which is notorious and unreliable, to minima for an ILS, for an instrument landing system, which is much more accurate as a glide slope and a localizer. They're in heavy weather. They're off course. They had no way of knowing. They were, and when they recover these instruments, if you recall the old steam gauges, what we call these round dial instruments, there's ink on the back of the needle, so they can tell at the moment of impact exactly what the needle was reading. And these guys were dead on. They were doing everything right, but they had no way of knowing they were off course. It was before GPS. Minima were way too low for an incredibly unreliable ADF approach. So anyway, that's those are the three things. They go missed. They slammed into a mountaintop. There was one survivor, but she died on the way to the hospital. So every time I come across an article about this, and it's now over 25 years ago, right, or 24 years ago, I will submit some documentation talking about how this was not pilot error. These guys were very, very good. They were right on the money, but they had everything was stacked up against them. So that's the kind of thing that that pilots have to face someday. That everything can be lying to you, and you still have to try to pull it out. I've always asked my wife to pray before I go fly. I want to be the safest pilot for my passengers. So anyway.
Yeah, just
I thought your listeners.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
You thought
listeners might like to know something about that crash that hasn't made the news.
Yeah, you know, you always have tidbits of undisclosed information. We'll have you on, more times in the future to talk about, to leave these little Easter eggs of undisclosed information. Well, I didn't know that, but just to define terms for the audience, NDB, again, is non-directional beacon, and ILS is instrument landing system, and the precision differences between the two are, as Jay noted, about 800 feet minimum altitude over touchdown. So anyway, I do want to, before we let people go here, most people listening probably are going to fly but not be upfront doing the flying. Right. You mentioned something very critical, which I do every time I get on an airplane. And you may have similar procedures when you're taking a hop back, when you're flying back in the back of the airplane from one of your
deadheading.
Deadheading. And from one of your scheduled flights, trying to get back to home base. But I get on the airplane, I pull out that card, the emergency card, and I read the emergency procedures. And even if you've done this, people ignore those things. I look at the nearest exits, fore and aft of me, count the number of seats each way between me and those exits.
Very good.
And then I reach under the seat to make sure the life vest is there, even if I'm on an overland flight. Murphy's Law, you can fly over a desert and crash into the only lake within, 1,000 square
miles.
Yep. And so it also makes sure the seat cushion, which is usually Velcroed on, which can also be used as a flotation device, actually comes off, and make mental notes. And I read the entire card, and I pay attention to the safety briefing.
And I appreciate that. I wish all passengers are like that. But sometime when you're doing that, scan your fellow passengers, and everyone's – I've actually gotten to the point where I make my captain's announcement. I said, I will consider it a personal favor if you guys – would give the flight attendants your undivided attention during their safety briefing, because I'd say 95% of people are not paying attention. They're not concerned.
No.
And, God help them if they have to open a door or if they have to go through a smoke-filled cabin or whatever. It's really discouraging.
Well, I come up with a mental plan. One of the it's something I've read in the past, about crash survivability in a commercial airline crash is that There are many, many times in which the crash is survivable. The airframe comes to a complete stop, but people die in the fire because they can't get out of the doggone thing. And they can't get out because they, you know, there's smoke. All that fabric inside the airplane when it burns is extremely toxic. And you will go lights out very quickly, which couldn't be merciful, but a plan in one's head how to exit that aircraft before something bad happens. God forbid, knock on wood against it, that it will. And air travel is the safest mode of travel on planet Earth. But preparation, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I mean, preparation is can be key because you know, and I frankly, and this is, you know, an honest comment, there's been occasions in which where I'm sitting, I can see somebody who is simply, I know they're not physically capable of getting out of that seat in a timely manner. And I've already formulated a plan to, you know, if I can help them, I will. But if not, I'm going over them. But I got to know where I'm going to be able to do that. And and formulating that plan, just doing those simple things, you know, it takes... It takes 2 minutes, maybe, if you read the entire emergency card that's in the seat back. It takes maybe 2 minutes max to do all of those things. Figure out where your nearest exits are. Count the rows of seats between you and those nearest exits. Look fore and aft. And make sure that your life preserver is in its container under the seat. Make sure the seat cushion does come off. It's Velcroed on. Make sure it will come off because you may not be able to reach under it and still be in water. And formulate a quick mental plan how to get from that seat to the nearest exit. And if that's blocked, how to get from your seat to the next one behind, you know, fore aft, front or behind you. And read the card just so you have that information in your mind. And then pay attention to the safety brief later. So that's a total investment of time of 3 minutes. And that's it. 3 minutes, and it could save a person's life if something bad were to happen. So just throwing that out there from, you know, two pilots, one a highly experienced
and good looking
airline pilot, and your host, who's just none of those things.
No. There, I know one great gal that thinks you're wonderful, at least. So, and remember, I'm the founder and the president of the Dirt Wasp podcast fan club.
Well, I appreciate that. You need to create a website and start recruiting. You know, I pay.
We have one member so far.
Yeah. Well, you got to start somewhere, and I appreciate you taking that start. Any last words of wisdom for our listeners about? You know, the airline industry, careers in aviation, or just, you know, tips, words of wisdom, anything related to today's topic that you want to leave us with?
I would say if you do want a career in aviation, that when it recovers, it'll be boom times again. And if you're a passenger, do like our host said, please behave, read the card, and dress appropriately. And always have an escape plan. And I guess that's probably it. I can't really think of anything else. It's a great industry. I love what I do. Now we all have to make announcements about masks, so please behave and wear your mask. And, you know, there's controversy about how helpful it is, but at least in a confined space like an airplane, please wear it and we'll be fine. So hopefully...
Yeah, and although you've referenced it several times, we're recording in January 2021, and the global COVID-19 pandemic is ongoing, and one of the mitigation factors that have been both requested and ordered some jurisdictions is to wear a mask over one's nose and mouth.
Yes, and if not for you, but for the person sitting next to you or whatever, and even though this is a very... active orders on all airlines, I still am getting reports that people demask, people are sneezing all over the place, and we really don't need that. Luckily, I've told this to a lot of people, the air cycles through the aircraft so quickly, you have some of the cleanest air that you'll ever experience. At 36,000 feet, you've got, you know, it's coming in through the engines, you've got extremely clean air, and then it cycles through the aircraft so quickly We do sanitize the aircraft. So we do take a lot of precautions. And I don't think there's any case that's traceable to catching it with, considering we fly millions of passengers. I don't think they've traced anything to, a super spreader in an airplane yet. Now, I just came through LAX, and it was like the zombie apocalypse. I've never been in such a huge airport and literally not seen anyone around me. It was nothing like I've ever experienced before. So California's completely shut down. And there are signs in California that say, wear your mask inside and outside. And I'm going, have you really thought that through? So I see people on bicycles wearing a mask, people driving their car with the windows up wearing a mask, people jogging wearing a mask. I go, I think we have lost our marbles here. But they didn't ask me. But anyway.
Do you mean you don't go to sleep wearing your mask?
I don't shower with it generally.
Oh, Jiminy Cricket.
I know.
Atrocious behavior, sir.
And when I'm in a field all alone, I don't mask up. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
You rapscallion.
Yeah. Wow, I haven't heard that. Someone just used kerfluffle on a conversation with me, and I haven't heard rapscallion in quite a while. Quite very impressive, your command of the English language.
Well, I'm trying to bring certain terminology back, and that is one of them. So,
wow.
Well, Jay, now that we have bored, angered, and generally alienated our international
large
audience.
Segments of our audience.
Yeah, that's right. Large segments of it, if not the entire audience by now. I do want to thank you for coming on again. Always enjoy our conversations with you, both the ones that we record and the ones that we don't. And it's been a real treat having you on, and I sure appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. And as always, I'm at your service. And let me know anything else I can enlighten your viewers, listeners, and readers on.
Well, I'll do that. And, someday I'll be able to afford a camera where I can put the podcast up, and people can see, at least me. And then once this thing passes, the guests or guests also. But that's a little bit into the future since this is a new podcast. And again, I appreciate your help and coming on and talking about a variety of interesting subjects. So thank you for today.
Okay. All right. Well, my pleasure. And have a good one. And I'm at your disposal.
Thanks, Jay. All right. That was Captain Jay Seffern, airline Captain Jay Seffern, talking about the aviation industry, the history thereof, careers in aviation, some of the challenges in aviation, some little tidbits here and there, and for, some information for people who would like to have a career in aviation. And I really appreciate you guys tuning in once again to the latest edition of the Dirt Wasp podcast. Again, if you can refer this to a friend who you think might be interested in it, recommend the podcast to your friends who consume podcast content. Give us a like, a thumbs up, 5 stars, whatever you can do to help build the podcast is very, very much appreciated. And until next time, adios.